measurements. That's a lot of loss. He could, if he wanted to, after he cuts that slot with his Dremel tool in the outer diameter of his Andrew Heliax, he could solder two vertical plates above and below that slot. If the slot is if he's got the cable laying on the table from left to right, and he's made a slot from left to right, he can put two vertical slabs soldered to the coaxial cable outer diameter, one further away from him and one closer to him, one on the near side of the slot, one on the far side of the slot. In other words, he can add the vertical slabs to his Andrew Heliax so that it starts looking like his 805 slotted line. And he can force it to be waveguide beyond cutoff. He's got the same amount of monitoring capability once he puts his probe in there, but now it will not radiate at those frequencies. So he can control that. Now, if I put a square wave down this slotted line, or down this slotted piece of Andrew Heliax, let me drop. Each individual frequency of the square wave, if it's a truly 50% duty factor square wave, it has nothing but odd harmonics. It's got the fundamental third harmonic, fifth harmonic, seventh harmonic, and so on. I can test the shielded characteristics and slotted waveguide characteristics at each one of those frequencies. Assume my main frequency is 1 gigahertz, and I'm making a 1 gigahertz square wave. I know that inside that 1 gigahertz square wave, there's a lot of 1 gig, there's a fair amount of 3 gigs, there's quite a bit of 5 gigs, there's some 7 gigs, there's some 9 gigs, all the odd harmonics are there. I can test that system at each one of those frequencies, one at a time, with my signal generator and with my test equipment. I can put each one of those frequencies in there one at a time. Now when I put the real square wave in there, it will obey superposition. Whatever amount of dB of shielding I had at 1 gig, whatever shielding I had at 3 gigs, whatever shielding I had at 5 gigs, I can now put it all together. Those are individual voltage vectors. I measured them individually. I can now add them together in a vector manner and figure out exactly what's going to happen when I put that square wave in there.
20 kilohertz component.
Say that again.
How about 20 kilohertz component of the square wave?
If it's a 20 kilohertz square wave, and it's a truly square wave, then it's got 20 kilohertz, 60 kilohertz, 90 kilohertz. It's got all the odd harmonics. Let's see, 20 is the fundamental. 3 times that is 60. 5 times that is 100. So it's going to have 100. It's going to have 20 gigs, 60 gigs, and 100 gigs. Those are the components of a 20 kilohertz square wave. I said gigs, I meant kilohertz. So the individual frequencies, by the Fourier series, you know exactly what the components of that square wave is, if it is a pure square wave. Life gets a little bit more complicated if it's not exactly square. In other words, if it's a positive 55% of the time and negative 45% of the time. Now it's also got some even harmonics, but they're also very predictable. But now you add the real square wave that you're operating with, which has got some ringing functions. You have to figure out the Fourier series of the ringing functions. Your spectrum analyzer will tell you how much of each frequency is there. And each one of those frequencies has a certain shielding characteristic when it goes through your structure.
They will obey superposition.
Until you arc things over, where you start running into negative impedance, until you get to that point, everything is linear. All transmission lines that are used in a reasonable manner obey superposition. It is a thoroughly passive linear structure.
But if you implement mismatch at the end,
doesn't matter. Even when you've got standing wave ratio, the signal going from east to west on your transmission line hits your core load and a certain amount of it reflects back, and now the signal is going from west to east. The signal from going from east to west and the signal going from west to east in the transmission line do not see each other. They are thoroughly independent events, up to the point where you get an arc over or some other kind of nonlinearity. Even though those signals going east to west and west to east came from the exact same signal generator, doesn't matter. They are independent events. Ain't that crazy? That's how a directional coupler works. It doesn't care that there is a standing wave.
So there is never extension of the E field or H field over the slot.
You got to be careful now. If I'm using a directional coupler, like a bird wattmeter, and if I'm using a slug that is well-tuned, got high directivity, I can measure how much power coming out of the transmitter is going up the transmission line. I can measure how much power is reflecting off the antenna and coming back down the transmission line. When I'm using a directional detector, the two events are thoroughly independent. But when I put a simple wire probe down that 805 slotted line, which is a non-directional coupler, now I'm contaminating the world a little bit. The transmission line itself, the coaxial cable, the center conductor inside the 805 slotted line, keeps the signal flowing from east to west and west to east thoroughly independent from each other. But when I put that simple piece of wire in there, which doesn't give a damn about direction, it picks up some of the signal going from east to west, it picks up some of the signal going from west to east, and in a vector manner, it adds the two together. And then it goes into the crystal detector and comes out of the BNC connector of that carriage. So the probe mixed the signals together. The coaxial cable did not. The probe did it because it is a non-directional detector. Let me see if John understood that first. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, I do, Dick. I understand because I've run some experiments running that probe up and down and seen some very strange results with different mismatches on the end of it. If it's totally matched, you'll get one reading. If it's a jumble of signals, yeah, you'll get some crazy readings, and you know right away that can't be right.
Yeah, using a slotted line when there are harmonics present, it's not impossible, but it gets very complicated. It gets really nasty. If you had the ability to make a variation of the slug that's in your bird wattmeter, which had a long enough probe to it so it reaches down inside the slotted line, but it is a directional detector. That's what your slug of your bird model 43 power meter is. It's a directional detector. You aim it in one direction, it measures forward power. You aim it in the other direction, it measures reverse power. If you could make a variation of that and slip it down into that slotted line, and now you move that carriage, nothing would change. In one direction of that probe, you would measure forward power, and as you slide it with the carriage, nothing would change. Reverse the probe, and it'll measure reverse power, and as you slide the carriage, nothing would change. Wouldn't that be crazy if you actually did that? Over to you, John.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, you just gave me a good idea because I have some very small directional couplers with SMA connectors. They're about an inch long, and they probably would fit under that carriage, and I could have a probe extend from that to pick up the signal. That might be something that'll work.
Yeah, there are some Nader and other type of strip line directional couplers, but they're not really an open structure. The directional coupler has a straight through line going through the middle of it, and it's got a parallel line, which is the coupled line, and the parallel line has just got the right Z odd and Z even, and it's got the right termination on the end so that it has directivity. To reestablish that directivity with the center conductor going down your slotted line, it's doable. You could build a structure that does that. You could build a foam structure. I'm getting an idea here. You could build a foam structure that goes down and touches the center conductor, and it can be slid along the center conductor, and it's got a parallel piece of wire that lays parallel to the center conductor, and the piece of foam keeps the spacing away just right. And now that piece of wire, that parallel piece of wire, is going to come up to a detector on one end. The other end of the wire is going to go to a terminating resistor. The terminating resistor is going to have sliding finger stock that picks up one of the ground plane walls of the slotted line. So the the terminating resistor gets terminated, it gets properly grounded, even though it's sliding.
A sliding loop?
It could be a loop, but there's got to be a resistor in there, John. When you choose the right resistor, then you get directivity out of that directional coupler that I'm describing. It's got to have the right magnitude of resistor at one end and your detector at the other end. But you could build a sliding directional coupler in your slotted line. When you do, in one direction of orientation, it'll measure forward power only. In the other orientation, you pick it up and reverse it and put it back down there, it'll measure reverse power. But now, as you slide it along the slotted line, no change would happen. It would be a real eye-opener. It would really prove what I'm saying for some time now. Every reasonable transmission line keeps the forward-going power and the reverse-going power as thoroughly independent events. It doesn't mix them together. You probably heard my example of the pool of water or the guy wire, which supports the same thing. Back to you, John.
Yes, how the drops of the ripple in the water, they pass each other and don't affect it, or you're wrapping on your guy wire. Yes, understand that.
And in the case of the guy wire, I could make the first pulse going up and down, going up the cable, and it hits the tower and it starts reflecting back toward me. The second pulse could go left to right. And even though they're different in polarity, they still will pass through each other with no interaction. Into XJN, K2RIW.
I'm going to risk the statement, Into XJN. Implementation of the square wave creates VSWR always. There will never be the impedance match. And I support that multiple reflection happens, because if there is a series of impedance changes, each one will cause the reflection. So the total reflection in the vector addition of each of the individual coefficients could be accounted for the distance between the discontinuities. So even through the calculation, it would be almost impossible to measure the VSWR.
Absolutely not. If your termination is a broadband termination, if it's a 50-ohm transmission line and you've got a broadband 50-ohm termination, then each of the individual frequencies of the square wave will all be properly terminated. There will be no VSWR from a square wave. That's how a TDR operates. A time domain reflectometer makes the most nonlinear looking square wave like thing you've ever seen. You put that into a 50-ohm transmission line with a broadband 50-ohm termination on the end of that transmission line. Every bit of that quasi-square wave coming out of that TDR gets absorbed, and none of it ends up as standing wave ratio. If now I put a square wave at, let me pick a number, 432 megacycles into my 432 Yagi antenna, where my Yagi antenna is a beautiful 50-ohm load at 432, but the third harmonic at 1296, it's a lousy load, that particular square wave into that particular antenna is going to give me a lot of reflected energy at 1296 megacycles. For instance, it's not a broadband load. Most antennas are very narrowband when it comes to square waves. So many of the circuits you work with are not a broadband load, and yes, they make a lot of VSWR on square waves. It doesn't have to be that way. If it was a broadband termination, it'll absorb every one of the subharmonics, every one of the Fourier series components of that square wave. It can absorb all of them if it's a broadband termination. Over to US, K2RIW.
Thank you very much for that explanation. But I wasn't at the beginning of the discussion when we were talking about the radiac. Present in front of the radio. The radio definitely gives you the means of leaking signal from the coaxial cable. That means that we're dealing with the E field and H field going out. I'm trying to determine how is that possible if we have a superposition of a superposition.
The way radiax works is you've got a whole bunch of periodic holes drilled into the outer conductor of what looks like Andrew Heliacs. And each one of those holes is radiating a very small amount of signal, probably 50 dB suppressed compared to the signal going down the center. And the periodicity of those holes is such that if you could see the signal coming out of the radiacs, if you got a piece of radiacs lying across a field,
on the table, let's say 10 feet of the, horizontal on the table, and you have a hole,
then there's a very weak signal coming out of there, and the very weak signal comes out, you would think it's coming out at right angles to the cable. There's really a slight slant to it, because the holes that are closer to the signal generator are getting the signal earlier than the holes that are further downrange. It is a kind of a phased array. It's a phased array which has a distribution slant, a phase angle distribution slant along the length. Therefore, the signal comes off there at a certain angle, not exactly at right angles to the cable, but it is a phased array antenna.
So in other words, we cannot have a flat, we have to have a circle of holes. Is that correct?
No. Nothing magic about round holes, oblong holes, or slots. I'll admit that life gets complicated as you start making the slots a half wave long. Other phenomena starts happening. But up to the point where the slots are less than a half wavelength long, each individual slot, each oblong hole, each round hole is a small piece of waveguide beyond cutoff. But the z-axis of that waveguide is very small. If the outer diameter of your Andrew Heliacs is made out of copper that is a 60th of an inch thick, then your waveguide beyond cutoff has a z-axis of a 60th of an inch.
So in other words, my understanding is that the length of the slotted line is important to a basic proposition.
Ambiguous question. I think the answer is no. Reword it.
Oh, boy. I'm trying to determine at which position we have the E field extending, or H field, or both of them extending through the slot or through the hole, and in which one, in which we have a one that is never going to go out. So I'm trying to determine the difference between the slotted line and radiac.
If John was going to take his slotted line, and he's operating at 432 megacycles, so he puts a 1-watt transmitter at 432 megacycles into a slotted line, and the far end of the slot has got a 1-watt dummy load. So along the center conductor, there's a predictable amount of signal. Because the vertical sides of the slotted line are so high, the amount of signal that squirts out of the upper end of that slot and the lower end of that slot, you know, toward the table and up to the zenith, up to the sky, is 100 dB suppressed. But now John comes along with this great big metallic woodworking plane, so to speak, and he starts shearing off the top of his slotted line. He starts making cuts in the slotted line right at the upper surface, but he's making cuts parallel to the table. And he's now cutting away that material, and so the distance between the center conductor and the outer air up above is getting closer and closer. And we now know 27 dB per ground plane spacing. We can predict ahead of time exactly how much signal he's going to radiate as he makes each one of those cuts.
That means if the radiac is lying on the table, you make a horizontal slot with the Dremel tool along the radiac, nothing is going to happen. But if you make a 90 degrees cut, 90 degrees to that slot, now you're getting the radiation.
There's a yes and a no to that. The cut that he's got in his slotted line is a cut along the z-axis. The opening is along the z-axis. The holes in the radiacs are slightly oblong holes. The major dimension is along the z-axis of the cable. Yes, the slot will radiate a hell of a lot faster if you make the cut across the cable as opposed to along the cable. It'll radiate a lot faster, without a doubt. But even if you make all the slots parallel to the center conductor, it will still radiate because the thickness of the copper is so thin that the amount of exposure there is between the strong E field inside of the dielectric material coming right up to the outer conductor. The outer conductor is only a few thousandths of an inch thick, and then it's open to the air because that distance it has to go through of the slot is so small, it will radiate. That's how Radiax works. If you made those slots very tall by adding sheets of copper above and below the slot, if you know what I mean, parallel to the slot, you solder down some sheets of copper so that it looks like his slot is lined, you will stop it from radiating. The waveguide beyond cutoff will now become more and more ground plane spacing, so to speak, and the signal coming out of the top of the slot will get smaller and smaller.
Over to you, Winston.
Thank you very much for this explanation. Now, I'm trying to connect, I have a bunch of questions that are related to coaxial cable. And the...
We'll pick you up, Doug, don't worry.
Strange. You look at them for the first time, you look, what the heck? At first I would like to ask the question, which is a trivial one. What is an ion?
Yeah, before we change subjects, Doug wants to ask a question. Go ahead, Doug, on coaxial cable.
W-A-2-S-A-Y to net. This is a follow-up on what I had brought up before. It's really not coaxial cable. It's the waveguide beyond cutoff again. I found a reference on the Internet from an outfit called CanaryTech.com. They have a downloadable section called Attenuated Design Reference Manual. Their equation number 39 on page 465 claims that the attenuation is exactly 32 dB per diameter.
How about that? Which I think is very close to the 27 dB, but because it's a round structure instead of a triplate strip line structure, I think that accounts for the difference. So 32 dB per ground plane spacing. How about that? And is that almost independent of frequency? And I think it is, as long as the waveguide is beyond cutoff. Over to you, Doug.
Roger, in round waveguide, it's 32 dB per diameter, as long as you're significantly beyond cutoff. I don't know it didn't go into a great deal of detail, but I would assume if you're like 10 times below cutoff, you're independent, completely independent. That's just a round number off the top of my head, but I would assume that's probably correct.
Yeah, that makes sense. The round piston attenuator that's on a Hewlett-Packard 608, I've seen one of those. I'm guessing it's around 3/4 of an inch in diameter. 3/4 of an inch in diameter is a good waveguide until you get to 10 gigs. I mean, above 10 gigs, it's a good piece of waveguide. It's got a cutoff of around 7 or 8 gigs. The Hewlett-Packard 608 goes from 10 megacycles to 450 megacycles inclusive. So it's at least 10 to 1 below cutoff. You'll notice that the dial, the signal generator power output dial, doesn't have any frequency markings on it. You can set it to minus 10 dBm, and in theory, when you properly calibrate the machine, it'll give you a minus 10 dBm signal whether you're at 450 megs or you're at 10 megs. And it's all going through that exact same piston attenuator. So I think that piston attenuator is very flat versus frequency. That's about the way you see it, Doug, to the H2SAY, K2RAW.
Roger, Dick, that's correct, and the thing here I'm looking at, let me see, it's got some specs on a typical Weinschild attenuator. Let me see if I can bring the page up a little bit here. They're talking about an accuracy of 0.01 dB from 0 to 15 dB, and 0.005 dB per 10 dB from 15 to 100 dB. So, very accurate attenuation and a resolution of 0.001 dB for direct reading digital indicator. Well, I don't know what the digital indicator on this particular device is, but this is some kind of a Weinschild attenuator. So it's apparently extremely accurate to that number that they give you, 32 dB per diameter. WA2SAY, back to net.
And both on rectangular waveguide and round waveguide, the signal goes down that guide, it must zigzag from left to right, so to speak. It bounces off the narrow walls in rectangular guide, it bounces off the sides of round guide. And the angle of bounce is exactly determined by the frequency and the dimensions of the guide. When you go to a low enough frequency when the waveguide is just becoming beyond cutoff, the bounce angle goes to exactly 90 degrees. The signal is bouncing back and forth between the two sides of the guide, and in theory it has zero forward propagation. So the signal is simply bouncing back and forth right at the point where it was generated, not propagating down the guide. The only thing that's propagating down the guide, you could call it a little bit of leakage signal, and that leakage signal falls off in a very predictable manner in dB per inch, once you know the dimensions of the guide. It's kind of nice and handy. So some very precision attenuators have been made that way and cover a lot of octaves of frequency. Let's see, now 10 megs to 450 megs, there's a lot of octaves in there. And if you wanted to, you could make that signal generator go down to 1 meg or 100 kc, and it could, in theory, use the exact same piston attenuator. Now, let me drop.
KC2, do you like you with the question, Tech?
Go ahead, Glenn.
In a piece of coaxial cable, wavelength is pretty much directly proportional to the length of the cable. So in other words, if you know the velocity, you know, factor of the cable, and you know the approximate wavelength, you can determine, you know, the delay down the cable as you, with units of length. In the waveguide, how does that work? Is it similar? I don't think it is. Is it? KTORZWKC2QIQ.
Once you know the angle of bounce, and you can easily calculate that, knowing the frequency and the dimensions of the guide, or let's call it the wavelength of the frequency you're sending down there, and the number of inches of the guide, you can calculate the exact angle of bounce. And it's going to zigzag down there, and if the zigzag happened to be at a 45 degree angle, for instance, and the square root of 2 is a 45 degree, you know, length of hypotenuse versus the side, the velocity of propagation of the, standby now, group velocity would be square root of 2 slower than free space. That's the group velocity. The phase velocity is always faster. Of course that's crazy. And I'll explain that one if you want. Should I explain why phase velocity is always faster than the speed of light, and group velocity, the real velocity, is always slower than the speed of light? Over to you, Glenn.
No, that's okay. That part's already understood. I was just wondering how, with the dimensional, with the dimension of the waveguide, that the group delay as you go through there, and I think you pretty much explained it, but it still doesn't quite ring. I'm still not completely on page with the group delay. In other words, when you're calculating that for the angles, because I would intuitively think that if, let's say, if the angle was like 45 degrees to a bounce, and you have 360 degrees, basically, it's that much more time, or you know, that much more length added to the group delay. If you follow what I'm saying,
the group delay really is a geometry problem. If you know the angle of bounce with reference to the z-axis of the transmission line, you know the amount of group delay. In other words, if you're putting a pulse down there, and you know you started off the leading edge of the pulse at t0. You'll know exactly when that pulse is going to arrive, but there's a catch. Do you know that all waveguide is dispersive? Dispersive means the higher frequencies travel faster than the lower frequencies because of this angle of bounce jazz. A pulse that you and I put down there is, by definition, a sine X over X type thing. It's got a Fourier series to it. It's got a whole lot of individual frequency components, some of them higher and some of them lower, of a repetitive pulse train, and the higher frequency components will propagate faster. They arrive sooner. Because the high frequency components arrive sooner than the lower frequency components, your beautiful square wave starts becoming sloppy, depending on how many wavelengths it's been through. In the case of a broadcast tower where you've got a tower that's 1,000 foot high, and you've got waveguides sending your signal up that tower, the fact that the signal is dispersed, the waveguide is dispersive, let me drop it. The fact that it's dispersive can give you a lot of grief when it comes to carefully controlling the phases of a broadband signal like a color television signal. If that chrominance subcarrier at 3.579545 megacycles, if the chrominance subcarrier of a colored television NTSC picture is not correct in phase to the nearest 1 degree or so, then Jay Leno's face turns green, if you know what I mean. So to make all of those individual components of that 6 megacycle wide signal come out correctly, you have to pre-distort it. You have to send the high-frequency components into the cable delayed compared to the low-frequency components to make it all come out right at the top of the tower. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there. It doesn't seem as if broadband communications and waveguide are really made for each other. Certainly coax would be a much better choice in that area. But I'm always intrigued with certainly using the waveguide in amateur use all the time, you know, looking at, microwave frequencies of, 10 gigahertz and above. And it's just, really trying to understand it. I've taken some measurements on it, and especially when I've looked at, like, group delay, things like that, getting some crazy measurements there, Dick. Back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The 3/4 inch diameter water pipe that's sold in Home Depot has considerably lower loss as a transmission line at 10 gigahertz ham band than does mil-spec, silver-plated, dry nitrogen-filled WR90 waveguide. Ain't that crazy? It's got lower loss than the best stuff you can buy, and it's cheap as all hell. That's the good news. The bad news is the frequency range over which you can use it is like 3 times more narrow than it is with rectangular guides. Second of all, you better make sure that you've got control of the axial ratio, the ellipticity of your copper pipe. I remember once taking a set of calipers into Home Depot and picking up a bunch of copper pipe and rotating it in my calipers to find out how close to round it was. The guy running the department came along and said, "Oh, another one of these engineers doing a precision plumbing job." I couldn't tell him that I was about to use it as waveguide. He wouldn't understand. I let him rant and rave that I'm a precision plumber. A crazy precision plumber.
Hey, Dick, isn't that the name of a microwave engineer?
Oh, yeah, they're a little crazy.
To go this far, I was talking about the plumber part.
Yeah, it turns out that the 45-degree elbows, the 90-degree elbows, the transitions from 3/4 inch to 1 inch to 1.5 makes beautiful horns, and the elbows make beautiful waveguide miter joints. The only thing you have to do with a round waveguide when you're using copper pipe is you have to put little sheets of copper in there as septums periodically to make sure you're controlling the polarization. Other than that, the small amount of runout of the pipe is such that you may launch a horizontal signal at the bottom of the tower, and it may arrive as a vertical signal at the top of the tower. As long as you've got a waveguide to coax adapter, which you can rotate on the pipe, you can correct for that. But you can easily end up with the signal shifting in polarization as it goes down the pipe. In fact, there's a way that you can intentionally squeeze the pipe just right, make it a little bit oblong, and you can make a polarization rotator mechanism inside of your transmission line. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW. The smart guys have done that.
Yeah, I'm not one of the smart guys, but actually, I'm just thinking to myself, how are you actually putting a connector on the end? In other words, most of the professionally used waveguide has got the nice little flanges and the nice little pieces where you can actually connect up to it. And I'm just wondering, how do you actually mount flanges and things on the end of on the round pipe? Is there some trick to that?
Oh, boy, is there a trick. And the trick is do nothing. All of your couplings telescope. Even before you solder a joint, when you telescope two joints together, they telescope by, what, half an inch? There is no leakage across that joint. You can plug together all of your pieces of copper pipe with all of those unions and elbows and everything else. None of it soldered. Just held together with the, with chewing gum and thread or whatever. And it will work like a charm. No leakage takes place. You can make a dummy load in the round piece of coax cable, in the round piece of a three-quarter inch diameter pipe, by taking a three-quarter inch diameter broom handle and whittling it down as if you were sharpening a pencil. It makes the world's most beautiful dummy load. The small amount of moisture that's in the wood, and as long as the wood is about 3 inches long inside of the copper pipe, it absorbs every bit of that signal. And with very careful measurements, I found out the reflection coefficient was minus 30 dB. By just whittling the piece of pipe, the dowel, into what looks like a pencil. And you could make a good dummy load. You could make a dummy load that's got a 20 dB reflection coefficient, a 30 dB reflection coefficient, and a 35 dB reflection coefficient. And you study the two and you find out what's the difference. And the answer is, how sharp is the tip of the point of the pencil of the way you whittled it down? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
I wasn't even thinking that far ahead. That's pretty cool. I got to try that one time. But actually, my question was even a little more simple than that. It was actually like, if I were going to make measurements with a piece of pipe and I wanted to look at insertion losses and other things like that, generally I'm going to be using probably pipe and cable to test equipment. And I was just wondering, what kind of adapters, and how do you connect from, let's say, pipe end from your coaxial measurement equipment over to the piece of pipe in order to use it as a transmission line?
I own a metrology grade 20 dB waveguide WR90 directional coupler. It has more than 50 decibels of directivity. So in WR90, I can measure forward signal and reverse signal, and I can resolve one versus the other by over 50 decibels. That's the good news. And I can launch a signal into the WR90 with a simple type N to a waveguide WR90 coax adapter. So launching the signal into the waveguide is easy. Now, at the end of the WR90 waveguide, if you very slowly taper that into three-quarter inch round copper, and you can do that by taking a round piece of copper and pounding on it just right so that it starts off round at one end and 6 inches downrange it is rectangular and it goes into a flange, you've now got a transition between round and rectangular. That's one approach. Let me drop. The other approach is you take a copper end cap and approximately 3/8 of an inch from the end cap, you drill a hole in the side and install a SMA female-to-female adapter with the nuts on the inside and the outside to hold it into the end cap. From the center conductor of the female SMA female-to-female adapter, you put a little whisker of wire that's about a quarter of an inch long, carefully adjust the length of the wire, bend it a little bit forward and aft. When you get it just right, it will launch a signal into your round copper pipe with a very good standing wave ratio. You can easily get 25 dB of reflection coefficient with that end-cap launcher. And the end-cap launcher telescopes onto your next piece of copper pipe, and you get very little leakage on that overlapping joint even before you solder it. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
What's interesting about this launcher is that's something that's really confused me, even with the regular, the commercial waveguide, is that the length of those little whiskers or that enter the waveguide, is there, what's the relationship to length and the centering to the, when you put something in the center and the length, it doesn't look like those are anything near even quarter wavelengths, are they then?
No, they're not. Simplistically, if you look at a rectangular waveguide coax to waveguide adapter. There is a launching probe in there which looks like a quarter wave ground plane, but it's less than a quarter wave long for a very good reason. The real impedance inside the guide, in the case of rectangular guide, it is lower than 377. In the case of round guide, it's greater than 377 ohms. On top of that, you're launching that whisker approximately a quarter wavelength from the short-circuited end. So the combination of the short-circuited end, the impedance inversion that creates, the local E-field that you're launching, and the fact that you're trying to make all the reactances go to zero, there is an exact length of probe, an exact position of probe, that'll launch a 50-ohm signal into your type N connector. It's a slightly complicated function, but you're absolutely right. In general, it's less than a quarter wavelength long. As you make a probe less than quarter wavelength long, it's capacitive. The way the guide acts in the way you're launching the signal, the guide acts inductive. You can see how it comes out right. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
If I were going to experiment and try this, I'm just wondering, would it make sense to try something like a type N connector with some kind of a cap, or maybe the connector's too large? Maybe I should really start with the SMA and then attach wire length starting at a quarter wavelength on both ends, on caps on both ends, and then adjust the length until I get a very, very good low insertion loss and return loss through the cable. Does that make sense to you, Vic? And to try to find both lengths of the whisker and see what actually works best, and then I can probably pretty confidently then use those kinds of typical end caps with whiskers with the connector as launching and recovery devices on the other end of the waveguide, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes, I do, and you've made it too complicated. What you just described makes good common sense. To do it in practice, you're going to suffer. You're going to have some viswar on your signal that's getting launched. You're going to have some viswar on your launcher that's doing the reception, and the two are beating against each other, and the combination, the permutations and combinations are going to drive you up a wall. Because it is so easy to make an extremely high quality dummy load in round waveguide, an ordinary 3/4 inch dowel sharpened like a pencil shoved into the end of the pipe is an extremely good dummy load, 35 dB down. Because you can make a dummy load into a length of pipe, because you can put an end cap on the other end of the pipe and adjust the probe position in length until on the SMA connector, your viswar sensor, your network analyzer, or whatever, says you've got 50 ohms resistive and no ohms of reactance, a one-to-one viswar, you're there. So start off with a good dummy load in the round pipe, launch into it, and you're there in one step. Over to you, Glenn.
Good thing to know. And I'm sorry because I missed the earlier part of the discussion where you were saying, what's a really good diameter of pipe to use at 10 gigahertz?
The best diameter in the world is 3/4 inch copper pipe out of Home Depot. It has considerably lower loss than the silver-plated, mil-spec, dry nitrogen-filled WR90 waveguide that you can buy out of the Andrew catalog. The 3/4 inch diameter copper pipe out of Home Depot has considerably lower loss. Ain't that crazy? Over to you, Glenn.
You know I'm going to try this now. Now, the other thing is, for the dowel that you were putting, that you were sliding into the, into a dummy blank of the of copper tubing when you're building your end cap to check return loss on the end when you're making your launcher. I guess you're using something a little bit thinner than, 3/4 inch, whittling it down, and then trying to make a sharpened point at the end, and then basically use that as the dummy load for the tuning. Does that sound correct, Dick?
You're very close, Glenn. It's the moisture in the wood and the lost tangent of the wood that's acting like the dummy load, and if the point is sharp enough and the taper is gradual enough, the signal doesn't know it hit wood. It slowly gets tapered into the wood, and if the amount of dowel inside of your copper pipe is about 3 inches long, by the time the signal propagates through the sharp point into the wood, propagates through about 3 inches of wood, comes to the open end of the wood, which is open to air, some amount of it reflects. It reflects back through the wood, all the way back through that whole procedure. By the time it reflects back, that signal is about 50 dB down. The majority of the 30 dB reflection coefficient you see is how sharp is the tip of the pencil, if you know what I mean. The slight amount of moisture in the wood and the loss tangent of the wood is a beautiful lossy material. I'm going to guess it's got 10 dB of loss per inch one way, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
And how long and over how many inches would you make the taper?
I seem to remember the taper was about 2 inches. So 2 inches of taper, a total of 3 or 4 inches of wood inside of the copper pipe, and you've got an extremely good dummy load. Other guys have experimented with other materials to use as dummy load. Ordinary black rubber tire material. Chop up a piece of bicycle tire or a piece of automobile tire. All the carbon black and everything else that's in the tire is an extremely good lossy material. All you've got to do is make it into a very sharp wedge. Once again, the way waveguide works is that you can get away with murder if you do it slowly. If you slowly taper any material into the guide, it will absorb your signal beautifully and give you no reflection. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
And this sounds like something, a very, very interesting project I'd like to do. At least experiment with it and see what I can do. But, I'm wondering actually if even like RTD silicone, because I could probably even get some silicones that I could probably mold into that shape and actually get the cone shape on the end. That might work as well, I think, too.
There I'm a little bit worried. The silicone material is very dense compared to wood. Wood, I think, has got a dielectric constant of about 3. That silicone material, if I had to make a guess, I'll bet you the dielectric constant is 6 or 7, Glenn. It's such a drastic transition that you've now got to do a lot more taper to it, and that's going to be difficult. Tapering the wood is so easy, and the wood has always got a little bit of moisture in it. It works like a charm. In fact, we've even considered making bullets. In other words, you make a chunk of wood which has got a sharp end on each end, and you slip it down the waveguide, and now that is a fixed attenuator from either end. You can easily make a 5, 10, 20 dB attenuator. The only thing wrong with the attenuator is now you want to paint it with something that is waterproof, because however much moisture there is in the wood, you want it to stay constant. If you got a piece of wood strictly straight out of the Home Depot, a piece of 3/4 inch dowel, and maybe it was stored in their slightly damp warehouse for a while, and you're using it in your air-conditioned house and it's slowly drying out, your 10 dB attenuator today could become a 7.5 dB attenuator 6 months from now. So you want to coat it with something so that whatever moisture content it's got doesn't change. That's if you're making a fixed attenuator. If you're making a dummy load, you don't give a damn. Make it long enough so it absorbs all the signal. It'll never get dry enough so that it stops absorbing the signal, if you know what I mean. Your house ain't that dry. The driest environment I've ever been is the Mojave Desert of California, where the humidity was 5%. And boy, does your nose dry out fast there. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yes, it does. And we're just not that dry here, Dick. At least not on the island, anyway. But I don't want to hold up the web, but thank you very much. It's something I want to try, and I want to experiment with. I don't want to hold up the net for too long. I'm sure other people have other questions. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Back to you, Dick, and thanks again.
Yeah, W2DRZ is a ham in the... I think he's in the Syracuse area, where he's got something like 80 feet of power. Running up the side of the 80 feet of tower is 80 feet of 3/4 inch water pipe. That couples his 10 gig signal from the bottom of the tower to the top of the tower. Does a beautiful job. John in Western, that order. Go ahead, John.
I think I measured that 805. It's 2.25 inches, so I'm assuming it's like 61 dB, right?
What's the spacing between the two ground planes, and what's the spacing between the semiconductor and the outer air vertically up, if you know what I mean? So give me those two numbers.
The vertical is 2.25 inches, and it's almost 3/4 of an inch wide, the slot.
Okay, 3/4 of an inch into 2.5, multiplied by 27. When you did that calculation, how many dBs you come out with?
Oh, I just did the 2.25 times 27.
No, 2.25 divided by 3/4. I think you said the spacing is 3/4. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Stand by. Coming up with a number. You do that calculation, it comes out 81 dB. Is that good enough, John?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great amount of attenuation for that short amount of distance. Amazing.
Eight waveguide beyond cutoff. It's a very nice science. And until you get to 10 gigahertz, where that 3/4 inch spacing starts becoming an antenna, until you get there, it'll keep doing that 81 dB of loss. So you now know that when you put a probe on the outside and looking right at that open 3/4 inch hole, you are looking for a signal, 81 dB signal weaker, 81 dB weaker than what was on the center conductor. If I know you, you put on the center conductor about 0 dBm, and until you set the spectrum analyzer just right, and you got just the right kind of a probe, measuring a signal of minus 81 ain't easy. Over to you, Glenn. Over to you, John.
PC2WGV. Oh, you're right. I've sent my sniffer down into it, and I had to get pretty far into it before I could pick up a signal. But I haven't tried it, and looking at a 0 dB with trying to detect the 81, which I'm going to do.
Yeah, once you put your sniffer down in there, and you set the spectrum analyzer on a very narrow scan with a very narrow resolution bandwidth, now you can get super sensitivity out of the spectrum analyzer. Even before you add a preamplifier, you can make the spectrum analyzer where it normally has minus 85 dBm per megacycle of sensitivity, and you operate it down at 1 kilohertz instead of 1 megahertz, you pick up another 30 dB, you'll be good for minus 105, and you probably can go down to even a 10 kilohertz. Wait a minute now. 1 meg versus 1 kilohertz. That's 30 dB. You could go down to 100 hertz, which would be 40. You could get minus 115 dBm of sensitivity out of your spectrum analyzer before you add a preamplifier. Add 30 dB of gain in front of it, and you can get almost 30 dB more sensitivity yet. So once you zoom in first, knowing the exact frequency of a synthesized signal generator, now you'll have super sensitivity because you don't have to find the signal, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John.
Very good. Sounds like something interesting to try, and I will do that. I think Wesley had a comment.
You got it, Wes.
Okay, interesting. The time is passing by, so I have a bunch of questions. I think we have to go quickly through them, if you allow me to. First, I'm going to start because it's still about coaxial cables. Let me jump. When the the ions, where the atom is attracted to another atom because it has an equal number of electrons and protons, the atom is called anion, the other one is cation. Okay, fine, we know that. Now, one of the questions that I have that might sound extremely strange is what is the correlation between electrostatic ion thrusting force and electromagnetic ion thrusting force in coaxial cable? and to exist.
Yeah, you're talking about the Coulombic force and also the Lorentz force, I think is what you're describing. And once you know the strength of the magnetic field, once you know the strength of the E field, and once you know the amount of charge in coulombs of whatever it is that you're trying to measure the force on, there is a calculatable amount of Lorentz force and electrostatic force. So those websites that you sent me to have the calculation there. It's not in nice, simple form. You have to figure out the units, if you know what I mean.
I'm talking about coaxial cable. I'm talking about ion thrusting force in coaxial cable.
think you're trying to measure the ionic. In other words, with coax structure, you want to measure the magnitude of the ions or the force on the ions. What are you trying to measure? Go ahead.
Let's say we have the electrostatic ion thrusters, that would be the thrusting force is the that accelerates in the coaxial cable, and this one is in the direction of the electric field. Then the electromagnetic one will be will then use the Lorentz force to accelerate the ions. I'm trying to find out the properties of the ions in the coaxial cable.
Yeah, I think you're saying that if a radio signal is going down the coaxial cable, will the ions be propelled in some way? Is that sort of what you're getting at? Go ahead.
Well, first, let's establish the properties of the ions. Would that property of the ion will be a frequency, or the property of the ion will be vector?
Yeah, I'm having trouble with this one.
Let me put it this way. If we change the polarity, we're talking about the frequency of change of the polarity. Now we're dealing with the frequency, but still we're dealing with the vector.
Are you putting a DC voltage on the semiconductor of the coax cable and trying to figure out what the ions in the space around the semiconductor, what they're going to do? Is that sort of the question?
Absolutely not. I'm putting AC signal, electromagnetic wave, at a certain E field, so let's say 10,000 volts and more. Now I'm trying to find out how the ions behave in the coaxial cable.
Okay. On the positive half cycle, you're going to attract. On the negative half cycle, you're going to repel. And if the frequency is high enough, I don't think the ions get a chance to move. I think they're just going to sit and wiggle in place. I think the only real effect you're going to get is microwave oven heating, if you know what I mean. Go ahead.
Well, I have a problem with that because it's like you said, okay, we're dealing with the electricity and the AC signal is just going back and forth. You know, the electrons are wiggling. That would be the right analogy, which is not happening. It's moving forward.
Yeah, I think a AC signal on a cable is going to have very little effect on ions. Ions are charged particles. On the positive half cycle, they're going to be attracted. On the negative half cycle, they're going to be repelled. And if the frequency is high enough, they don't get a chance to move. I think they're just going to wiggle in place and not go anywhere, is my first guess, sir. Wes, go ahead.
I remember the comment of Glenn who said that circuit has to be closed either by electrostatic means or electromagnetic means. So before we go further, with the electric current in AC electric circuit, the charges wiggle back and forth, but the energy moved continuously forward. And this analogy to the way the sound waves move continuously forward through the air while the air itself wiggles back and forth. But if we, let's say, assume or we teach our kids that the electricity is made of electrons and electricity is also the energy that makes this would be a certain error. So my understanding is that if we're dealing with the sound waves, they are moving forward, even though they are wiggling, let me jump. That means the electromagnetic wave is also moving forward, even though there is wiggling, because it's altering current that it's doing. So then, because of the changing of the direction of the vector, we have a moving vector in the direction of the electric of E field, and the E field is moving.
Yeah, the RF wave going down the cable is energy going down the cable. A sound wave going through the air is energy going through the air. A wave in the ocean is energy going through the ocean. But the individual molecules of the ocean wiggle around, but they stay in spot. The individual molecules of the air wiggle around, but they stay on spot. I think the ions in the coax cable are going to wiggle around, but they stay on location. Energy is the wave is allowing energy to propagate, but the medium doesn't have to translate grossly to do it. It can just wiggle in position and transmit that energy. KQRIW.